Welcome to the Reasonable Faith Virtual Chapter Podcast. My name is Matt Bilyeu. This podcast has the audio portions of our discussions on a Discord server. I certainly recommend joining that server so that you can join in the discussion and see the slides. You can find a link to the server in the show notes. You can also email me at matt.bilyeu, that's B as in boy, I-L-Y-E-U, at reasonablefaith.org. That's matt.bilyeu at reasonablefaith.org. I look forward to chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. So this is my, I think, third presentation here. So it's exciting to be back that I keep getting invited to it. So it's nice. But today's presentation is called Divine Love Requires Incarnation, an Argument from Theism to Christianity. So as Matt kind of said, this is based on an a priori argument for something like the incarnation given theism. So for the sake of this argument, we're going to, you know, assume that God exists with all the properties. This is an argument to get from theism to Christianity, not an argument for God's existence itself. As you see on the second slide here, my inspirations for this are from Richard Swinburne's book, The Resurrection of God Incarnate, in which Swinburne basically does a Bayesian analysis with Bayes' theorem, a probability theory where he uses this, something like this kind of argument to put onto the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And he gets a posterior probability for the resurrection at about 97%. And that's assuming a prior probability of God's existence at about 50%. Luckily, though, we're not going to use a lot of math in this presentation, so you don't have to be worried about that. The other inspiration was Alvin Plantinga's book that came out a year, I'm sorry, his paper that came out a year after Swinburne's book did, which called Superlapsarianism or O Felix Culpa, in which he tries to propose incarnation and atonement as a theodicy for God allowing evil. And so I kind of incorporated this into my own book, which is on the next slide, of Searching for Solution of Suffering, which I wrote about 2 years ago about, you know, theodicy and the problem of evil. I have a chapter on what I call the Felix Culpa theodicy. And so that's kind of the basis on which the following presentation is based on. This argument is not exactly how either of them formulate it, and I've tweaked it from how I originally wrote it. But this is kind of the general idea that the idea that it's based off of. So next slide, you'll see that there's three main principles I'm going to be arguing for today. One is that God's moral character entails that he would want to express his love to his creation. Two is that incarnation is the best way for God to express his love to said creation. And three would be that Christianity is the best contender for such incarnation. And so therefore, we would say something like Christianity would be entailed under theism. So for the first premise, for the first idea, is God's moral character entails love, right? So when we say God, we're assuming a classical view of God, a triomnic God, where he's all-powerful, knowing all good, you know, omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. And so God will want to create a world that has high values because that is consistent with omnibenevolence. God wants to create the most values, and persons like us do have value in most circumstances. And so God would want to create that kind of world. And in creating that world, it's unlikely that God, being omnibenevolent, would just be deistic, that he would keep his hands off and, you know, dust his hands off and go on to do other things. No, God would want to be involved. God would want to have relationships with us and with other things. So humans, angels, and some more intelligent animals, perhaps, are unique in creation, that we have consciousness and that we have the ability to know God and to perceive of that. And with man specifically being made in God's image, we have the ability to become religious and to, you know, conceptualize God. And so it would be naturally good for God to be able to share in this relationship with us, and that is entailed under his omnibenevolence. He's not just going to ignore us in that way, because that would not be the right thing to do. But this raises an interesting question that we go into the next slide, is that how exactly would an omnipotent God even express love to finite creatures like us? So if we think of love, there's different forms of love, right? You can love pizza. You can love a hobby or an artwork, or the more fundamental kinds of love, you can love a family member or a friend, maybe so much so that you'd be willing to sacrifice things for them. And so I'd say that the greatest kinds of these love are ones that require some kind of sacrifice. It doesn't always require one's life, although it can be that if one is truly laying down one's life for someone. But generally, when it comes to resources like money or time or labor, et cetera, these are things that are limited. So for me to give money to a homeless person, me being someone who is, you know, modestly, who's of modest means, would not be, so that would be more loving than, for example, a billionaire like Bill Gates giving money to a homeless person, because although he can give more money, proportionally, it's not as much of a sacrifice. He has far less to lose from that, whereas someone who works hard for that is really giving up more. And so if this is the idea, it seems like it'd be difficult for us to imagine how an all-powerful God, what could he really give up to love us, right? And so this isn't to say that an omnipotent God can't love a finite creation. It's not an ontological statement, but it's more of an epistemic and epistemological statement. So it's saying not the question of how can God love us, but the question of how can we as created beings, how would we be able to recognize God's love through analogy, right? If we're so used to seeing love through sacrifice of finite creatures, whether it be our family members or friends or so forth, how do we see an omnipotent God do this, who can snap his fingers, you know, metaphorically and create anything, essentially? That doesn't seem to take any effort at all. And so it seems to be difficult to understand how this would actually express that God genuinely loves us in this kind of way. I don't think it's enough to just epistemically know that we can, you know, reason to this idea of, well, God's omnibenevolent, therefore he must love us, case closed, right? We have issues like divine hiddenness and the problem of evil, where we can say, yes, I know that God is supposed to be omnibenevolent and care about me, but it doesn't seem like in the world that's what we observe, right? It seems like there's lots of evil that God doesn't stop. It seems like often God's hidden from us. And so this makes many people doubt God's existence, or at least God's nature for caring for them. So in a world in which God's love is, you know, consistent with an omnipotent being, in which case he can only just basically snap his fingers and do anything and can't really sacrifice anything, I think many of his creation would feel a bit strained from that and would feel separated and would feel like they can't really feel the love of God in the same way they could feel the love of a parent in that way. It wouldn't mean the same to them. And so you have this issue where the relationship between the created creature and the creator would be strained for this exact reason, because it would be hard for us to understand what exactly love would mean. And so a solution to this, and I think an entailment if God really wants to express such love, would be incarnation. And incarnation in this case is just defined as God taking on visible human form in a way that's apparent to his creation. So by becoming incarnate, God is limiting himself in a way that is visible to us, that is obvious to us, so that he can express love. So instead of, you know, just clapping his hands together and having money or food appear from the sky, maybe he has to go work hard on a farm or teach us how to do that. Or maybe he has to get on his knees and wash our feet instead of just, you know, poofing them clean. Taking effort and really going through the hard grind of that, I think, is far more sacrificial and far more admirable, and really changes the relationship between us and God in that way. Another instance that I'll get down below is that it expresses a moral exemplar, but I'll skip that point for now. And the third point about the incarnation is that God has the ability to express empathy and really share in our suffering. We have to remember that we live in a world where there is plenty of evil that we have to go through and that we may be able to overcome, but regardless, when someone is watching from above, sitting on their throne, ordaining such evil, or at least allowing it, and even knowing that there is an end to that, I think many people can become quite cold to it. And as we do see with plenty of people, one can look at the French Revolution, for example, where the poor are starving and the rich are up there watching it. And we have the famous quote that Marie Antoinette did not really say, but that's still nevertheless applied to her, of let them eat cake, and the people get upset and overthrow the bourgeoisie and you know, execute them and all that stuff to show that they have animosity towards the higher classes, right? They don't know what they've gone through. They don't know how it feels to be poor when they're going through all that. So by God going through the suffering with us and being able to relate with that with us, I think expresses love far more in a way than him just watching us go through it in a way that we can really understand. The next part about being a moral exemplar, this is the point I wanted to highlight on as well. By becoming incarnate, God allows us, and of course, God is perfect under this example if he's omnibenevolent, but God would be able to express his love in a way where he could teach us how to behave. He could teach us moral truths, teach us how to love our neighbor, teach us how to find salvation, how to overcome evil. I think this would be expected, and we'd expect perhaps that an omnibenevolent God would not, even as incarnate, be able to sin or do wrong, because that would be a contradiction, but he could show us how to resist sin. He could show us how to resist temptation. And so there are many goods that can come from this.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you find these podcasts helpful, please subscribe and share them with a friend. Also, please join our Discord server for live discussions. You can find the server link in the show notes along with my email address. I'll see you next time.